listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and it has been a busy week on Capitol Hill. For the past few days, Congress has been racing to avoid a government shutdown. Thursday was the final day for lawmakers to pass a funding bill to prevent the government from that fate. And at the last moment, the House and Senate passed a stopgap measure before the midnight deadline. Also this week, the future of President Joe Biden's massive trillion-dollar infrastructure bill remains uncertain. Democratic Party leaders are struggling to strike a deal with more progressive members of their party, who have said they wouldn't vote on infrastructure until they reached a deal on the proposed $3.5 trillion social policy package. Here to break all this down are Nicholas Wu, congressional reporter for Politico, and Pablo Manriquez, who is Capitol Hill correspondent for Latino Rebels. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
So, Pablo, I want to start with you. Tell us about this stopgap spending package that was passed on Thursday. What does it cover, and how long is it keeping the door propped open?
As I understand it, it keeps the door open until December. So the government will remain funded until then. So people will get their paychecks. And that makes a lot of government workers really happy. But it also confuses the American people a lot, because it's like, what are we doing here? Do we not have enough money? Do we have enough money? So, yeah, I think that I think that the Republicans have created a lot of confusion for the sake of creating confusion and making it look like the Democrats have a problem governing.
And Nicholas, part of what this December date obviously does is it creates a holiday situation, right? So there's a certain politics to this question of are you gonna shut it all down just before the great holiday spending season begins? And I'm wondering, you know, this week Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said she favors removing the debt ceiling from Congress's control altogether. Is that the only way we're going to like just make some actual fiscal policy sense instead of this constantly being a political battle?
That, you know, in an ideal world, Congress would be able to pass an annual spending bill. They'd be able to deal with the debt issues on their own. They would be able to just come to bipartisan compromise and all that. But that's just not really what we've seen here. And you know, you mentioned no one necessarily wanting to shut down the government before the holidays, but you know, they've done that before too. What they've really done here is kick the can to the beginning of December, at least with the government funding issue. The debt issue is still entirely unresolved. I mean, the House passed its own measure to address the debt ceiling. But at the same time, Republicans in the Senate say that they don't want to raise the debt ceiling or vote to raise the debt ceiling on this kind of standalone measure. So, I mean, you know, we're really at square one here. and it's unclear exactly how they're going to resolve, at the very least, the debt issue for now.
And Nicholas, can the Democrats do it unilaterally, or will they have to have Republicans on board in order to raise that debt ceiling?
There's a little bit of dispute over that. And so there's a couple ways they could try doing this. They could try passing it through an ordinary bill, but then you still run into the filibuster, you know, that procedural measure in the Senate that requires at least 10 Republicans to sign onto a bill. That's unlikely to happen. So there's a separate process that they could use called reconciliation, which would only require a simple majority in the Senate to pass a debt ceiling increase or other kinds of fiscal measures. But the problem is there that takes a lot of time to actually draw up and run through the process of creating a budget and so on and so forth. And at least for now, Democratic leaders in both chambers have pretty much ruled that out, saying that they just don't have the time to try doing it alone. And so, you know, it's a very classic Washington issue, right? Like they're going to try to put something up and see who blinks first.
So, Pablo, let's switch gears a little bit and let's talk about that infrastructure bill. Remind us of kind of what is in that sucker.
Oh, my gosh, there's so much in that sucker. And the war going on within the Democratic Party over the infrastructure bill is fascinating, because you have this group of moderates, right? And they want an infrastructure bill vote prior to the reconciliation bill vote, that the reconciliation bill that Nicholas just mentioned. So what happened this week is that progressives said, and they've been saying this for about 3 months, that they will not vote. They will not vote for a infrastructure vote that comes before a reconciliation vote. Now, the reconciliation vote, the bill, has this, it's this huge spending measure that basically is the essence of Joe Biden's social agenda for his presidency. You know, you have a lot of things in there, from their child tax credit to, you know, just every type of progressive pipe dream of the last few years. And for the first time since the Obamacare vote back in the day, progressives didn't balk. Now, I'm old enough to remember when the public option was a raging debate in Washington. Everybody was talking about the public option, like the public option was going to be the thing that made Obamacare strong, the thing that made Obamacare progressive, like a legitimately progressive bill. And the progressives back then balked on sticking to their guns and saying, we will not vote for Obamacare if it doesn't have a public option. So fast forward to now, fast forward to this week, right? Now, progressives said, no, we're not going to vote for an infrastructure bill. And Nancy Pelosi, if you put it on the floor, we're going to vote it down and it's going to be humiliating for you. Premier Jayapal, the chair of the Progressive Caucus, has Ilhan Omar, one of the newer members of Congress who's been whipping votes for her. And this week, it came down to like a real standoff between the moderates and the progressives. The progressives did not balk. And for the first time in over a decade, Congress is actually taking progressives seriously. So I think that there's, if you are a progressive person, this is something to be very hopeful about. The progressives are actually showing teeth. They're not balking. They're not bluffing. They're sticking to their guns and they are getting at least what they want. In essence, Nancy Pelosi has to respect that these people will sink her agenda and in essence sink the Biden agenda if it's not done in the way that was promised earlier in the summer, which means that a reconciliation spending package gets coupled with a bipartisan spending package and they get put through together.
Yeah, Nicholas, it does feel like this, what Pablo just so beautifully described, right? That there are sort of two Democratic House speakers. There is the actual House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, but then there is Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal out of Seattle, Washington area, leading the Progressive Caucus. And, you know, that split isn't, you know, kind of around clear geographic lines. It's not around clear racial lines. It seems to be truly ideological. Is this something new? Again, like if we go back to, you know, early 2000s and the ways that there was sort of a progressive voice, but not this kind of institutional power?
To a certain degree, I mean, we're really seeing not just the evolution of the Progressive Caucus and progressives in Congress as a, you know, actual political force that, you know, is holding the line, so to speak, and is really putting it all out there to try to achieve their own priorities. But it also speaks to the really small majorities that Democrats have in the House and Senate. I mean, right now, it's important to remember that the Senate is split exactly 50-50 between Democrats and Republicans. And in the House, Democrats only have a 3-vote majority. And so any one member will have an incredible amount of power to try to get what they want, let alone something like the Progressive Caucus, which is over 90 members, or even, you know, it's worth remembering that moderates have had an outsized voice in all of this as well, whether that's, you know, a couple moderate senators in the Senate or, you know, folks like Congressman Josh Gottheimer in the House, who have also staked everything they want on trying to get the infrastructure bill through. And in particular, this week.
Let's put these insights together. And Pablo, when I hear you say, so if you're a progressive, you know, you ought to be a little bit excited about this moment. You see progressives like actually with some teeth and a backbone and a leader and all that kind of thing. But then if I go to Nicholas's point around this razor thin margin, which many believe will evaporate in the midterm elections due to redistricting and gerrymandering, and you're going to have a likely Republican-controlled House. Should I be excited about progressives, or should I ask them to please take a seat so we can get some legislation passed?
I mean, just for this term, the big difference between the progressives of today and the progressives during Obamacare, like two major progressive spending initiatives, right, is that these younger progressives like Ilhan Omar, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, some of these newer members, Cori Bush, they don't play, like, and they don't bluff. It seems at this point that there's nothing that Nancy Pelosi can offer them to make them break from their principles. You know, as you may recall, back during the Obamacare votes and the different negotiations going on, President Obama would come up to the Hill and he would talk to members like Raul Grijalva and some of these older guard progressives that used to run the Progressive Caucus and eventually kind of wear them down. I mean, you know, Ilhan Omar, she was born in a refugee camp. She's not going to be somebody who you just come up and push around. So I think that, like, it is hopeful if you are a progressive because you have people that are going to stick to their guns on principle. Now, does it mean in this all or nothing scenario of legislative vote counting that the Democrats could walk away with nothing? Yes. But at the same time, it means that progressives have a real meaningful voice and they're not messing around.
So, Nicholas, I think Pablo makes a good point about President Obama doing some vote whipping himself as president. Where's President Biden? Has he been making calls? Has he shown up at the Hill? Is he using what is always a fairly important pressure, the White House?
Well, the closest he's gotten to actually being in person with members of the Hill was being at the congressional baseball game a few days ago, where he showed up on the field, went to the dugout, and shook hands with members on both sides of the aisle. But beyond that, I mean, like Pablo said, he has not been making regular trips to the Hill. He's been, of course, making phone calls. He's hosted members at the White House to hear out their concerns and the like. But at least as of now, a lot of members aren't necessarily feeling the heat. I mean, the Progressive Caucus held this conference call on Thursday night as they were trying to figure out where they're going to go next. And a source on the call told me that the Progressive Caucus chair, Pramila Jayapal, told her members that she really wasn't feeling any arm twisting from the White House, Speaker Pelosi, or House leadership. And so, the people aren't quite feeling the heat yet, but as these negotiations drag out, we'll see who gives first.
I want to come, Pablo, to your beat, what you've really been working on, and that is about immigration and immigration reform. We've been talking here about, the progressive arm having a real voice, a real, structural power. Is there some possibility of meaningful immigration reform coming out of this Congress?
There is a possibility, but at this point, it's very, very narrow. So basically what's happened is that, like every time Democrats take power, they've promised a lot to immigrants. And the reason why they promise a lot to immigrants is worth noting here. More and more, increasingly within the Democratic Party's campaign infrastructure, it's immigrant groups that are providing a lot of the backbone to the organizing necessary to get people who can register to vote, who can vote, to vote for Democrats. So when Democrats win, when Joe Biden wins, when the House and Senate both go Democrat, these immigration groups are saying, well, okay, we got you there. Now it's time to pay up. Like, what is in it for us? So unfortunately, Senate Democratic leadership led by Charles Schumer, Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer, and Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois have put an unnecessary stopgap, if you will, an unnecessary barrier to entry into the reconciliation bill that Nick mentioned, that I've mentioned. So basically, it goes like this. Joe Manchin wins the House, but when the Senate Budget Committee Democrats came out and said, we're going to do a reconciliation bill, and they, the number has been tossed around. It's gone from $6 trillion to $1.5 trillion. It's all over the place. But one thing that was clear throughout the summer is that immigration reform was something that everybody, even Joe Manchin, supported, like some sort of legalization program for the undocumented population in this country. So Charles Schumer and Dick Durbin said, okay, fine, we are willing to push for this, but we're going to have to run it by the parliamentarian, the Senate parliamentarian, which is a Hill staffer who is basically like the lawyer for the Senate, who says, who advises them. The advice that she gives when you put a pitch or a proposal to the Senate parliamentarian is completely non-binding. And she said, no, like when they pitched her at what was now called Plan A for immigration, she said, no, there's no way that immigration, the legalization of immigrants can be put into this package. And the reason why, her job is to assess the budgetary impact of a certain measure on the reconciliation bill and whether or not that budgetary impact is direct or incidental. And her job was to basically say yes or no budgetary impact and yes or no direct or incidental. But instead, what Elizabeth McDonough, the Senate parliamentarian, did was issue this bizarre political statement saying that, yeah, sure, there's like a really direct impact that immigrants will create on the economy, or on the budget, rather. But it's way too much of an impact to be considered for a reconciliation package. So the more we looked into like the Senate parliamentarian, the more we realized that before ICE, before the Department of Homeland Security was created after 9/11, she was actually an immigration attorney. Now, we FOIA'd her records. Now, she was an immigration attorney so long ago that those records don't actually exist through FOIA, but we're looking for mentions of her in FOIA, because the impression that a lot of people have who worked at INS back in the day is that somebody of her role could have only done one job, and that is defend the deportations that the United States was doing at the time. So it seems to me like a really weird thing that you would have a deporter attorney like as the impartial arbiter of an immigration reform package. And Senator Durbin and Senator Schumer have worked with Elizabeth McDonough, the Senate parliamentarian, for over 20 years. So there's no way they didn't know this. So I put a poll up on Twitter that said, yo, do you believe that they're operating in good faith? Do you believe that Senate leadership, the Senate Democratic leadership is operating in good faith on this immigration bill? And no one buys it. Absolutely no one buys that they are operating in good faith, except for in the building. Like if you talk to the senators, they all love Elizabeth McDonough. If you talk to a lot of the press, they also say like Elizabeth McDonough is a great person. You go outside of the building and she is reviled. Like if any, the people who actually know who they are, the people in the immigration policy debate who are paying attention, they just say like, this is ridiculous. Like we won you the House, the Senate and the presidency. And now you're saying a Hill staffer is preventing us from receiving the basic human equality and human dignity that immigrants deserve in this country. So it's kind of a mess. I think that this is one of those situations where they put into place a political strategy that's going to come back to bite them, because when they call upon these immigrant groups to help them organize again during the midterm, the immigrant groups are not going to turn out. Like there is no incentive at this point when you have given Democrats all of the power that you can possibly give them, right? To turn around and say, you know, and then to have them turn around and say that like one of our subordinates says it's not okay. Sorry, guys, an unelected subordinate says that, you know, it's not okay for us to help you. So it's a really weird situation. It's a strategy that doesn't seem to work. And it's one of the dumbest political strategies I've ever seen. And in fact, because it's death by a thousand cuts, you know, every few weeks now we're going to have plan A, plan B, plan C of trying to get the parliamentarian to come over and say, yes, let's do some immigration reform. And every time she says no, people are going to be enraged. So I think that like to answer your question succinctly, there's one group of immigrants left that could be helped by a reconciliation bill. And that is the family and work-based visa backlog of over a million immigrants in this country, largely people from India who could have their status adjusted to citizenship or to a path to legalization. But in terms of the undocumented community, the 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country, the Senate parliamentarian has basically said, hell no. And they are upset. They are pissed and they should be. And you can read all of this at latinorebels.com. Where I report the news from Congress.
All right, great. Now, Nicholas, I want to come to you on this because sort of Pablo's story of, you know, one person standing in the way of important legislative action is in some ways really shocking, given that the person he's speaking of here, the parliamentarian, is unelected. But in the U.S. Senate, there are just a couple of people who are also having, as you had talked about earlier, outsized power in the decision making, particularly around these domestic policy packages. Can you talk a bit about Senators Sinema and Manchin and sort of what you see happening with them in this moment?
Well, both of them have staked out a very somewhat specific set of demands for what they want for this social spending package that Democrats are trying to pass. And that's really what is driving the conversation here. I mean, because at the end of the day, Democrats need all 50 senators to be on board with whatever package they try to pass. And so Senator Manchin in particular, as Politico had first reported on Thursday, wanted a package that was $2 trillion less than what Democrats had advocated for. So he wanted a $1.5 trillion social spending package instead of $3.5, in addition to any number of different demands about the maximum tax rates he wanted and ways to cap programs and the like. And so as a result, this has really served as a constraint in many ways on Democrats' ambitions here, because, you know, Senator Bernie Sanders, for example, had talked about wanting something as big as a like $10 trillion social spending package. But at the end of the day, you need something that people like Manchin and Sinema, some of the most moderate Democratic senators, are going to accept. And so there have been these furious negotiations between the White House leaders and Senate Democratic leaders with those senators to try to get them to accept some kind of framework for the social spending package so that they can move that forward. And with that, they can move the infrastructure package forward with it as well, because Democrats have tried to link those two pieces of legislation. And that's really been part of the problem here.
Nicholas Wu is a congressional reporter for Politico. And Pablo Manriquez is Capitol Hill correspondent for Latino Rebels. Thank you both for joining us, and thank you both for doing the work on Capitol Hill.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Thank you.
It's a natural disaster on a shocking scale.
In July, deadly floods ripped through Germany,
with heavy rain causing rivers to burst their banks, whole streets ripped away by the floodwaters, houses collapsed, livelihoods destroyed. More than 160 people have lost their lives.
The floods renewed the Germans' sense of urgency about climate change and pushed environmental and climate change issues to the top of the agenda for German voters, who were facing an election. And this election was going to be different than every other in nearly two decades, because Chancellor Merkel was not contesting to continue her leadership of the German government. Which is why a little thing that happened on July 18th proved so important to the future of German politics. Armin Laschet visited a stormed, ravaged community in Western Europe.
Und ich finde es sehr gut, dass die Länder und der Bund sehr frühzeitig signalisiert haben.
You can hear there the somber, serious voice of German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier explaining the damage, destruction, and death that the community has just suffered. But because this is radio, you can't see what is happening as the German president speaks. But just over his left shoulder, and in full view of the camera, there's Armin Laschet laughing uproariously. Laughing as he stands in a place where Germans have died due to climate change. Now, let me explain. The laughing Laschet was the candidate for chancellor from the Christian Democratic Union. Now that is Chancellor Merkel's party. Following in party leadership behind the still wildly popular Merkel, he should have been heir apparent. The CDU should have captured a plurality of German votes in this week's elections. Instead, he laughed at what Germans consider to be a time not for laughing. Days before the elections in Germany, thousands protested in Berlin as part of a global climate protest where climate activist Greta Thunberg addressed the crowd.
People are ready for change. We want change. We demand change. And we are the change.
Now, elections are complicated processes, but perhaps this moment, this laugh, is why Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party did not emerge victorious in last week's elections. Instead, on Monday, Germans cast the largest share of votes for the Social Democrats, led by Olaf Scholz. To learn more about what drove German voters in this election and how the process played out, I spoke with Yasmin Serhan from The Atlantic.
When Germans go to the polls, they would have a number of options. Obviously, not like the U.S. system. There are more than two parties, so more choices. You have the kind of the two stalwart center-right and center-left parties. You have the Christian Democrats, which is Merkel's party, and their sister party in Bavaria, the CSU. On the center-left, you have the Social Democrats. And then you have what I would say are smaller parties, though they've certainly grown bigger in recent years. You have the Greens, who performed very well in this election. You also have the pro-business free Democrats, who also did very well. And then you have parties on the far right and the far left, the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, being the far right variety, and then Die Linke being the far left. So in this election, what we saw was that for the first time in, as long as Merkel has been chancellor, the Social Democrats actually came out on top over the Christian Democrats. I know they have a lot of similar names, so hopefully people are able to follow the distinctions there. And that was, you know, pretty big, because in 2017, the Social Democrats didn't do so well.
All right, so let's start in the center, and then we'll go out to the far right and left, and maybe particularly to the far right. So let's start with the CDU, the Christian Democratic Union. That's Merkel's party. Now, it actually underperformed, right, as you point out, relative to center left, right, the Social Democrats party. How much did it underperform compared to when Merkel herself, you know, was going to be clearly the chancellor coming out of CDU?
The Christian Democrats, yeah, they lost support relative to before. Now, I mean, it's worth mentioning here that the center left and center right parties, these were the two big parties in Germany, they have been losing support kind of more and more as the years have gone on, in the sense that they've become less of these big all-encompassing parties, the of the kind that we would think of maybe like the Democrats and the Republicans in the US. And they've become smaller as smaller parties have become bigger. But what was notable about the Christian Democrats lost this time around is it's the first time that they didn't win the largest share of votes. I think that there's a couple of reasons for that, that I think kind of speak to why the CDU performed relatively poorly. I think the first thing, and this might sound pretty obvious, after 16 years in power, you know, I think a certain level of stasis kind of sets in. And, you know, voters, even though Germany, I think, was obviously very happy with Merkel, she remains a very popular figure in the country, I think there was a sense that they were looking for something new. And I think that was particularly true among young voters. And young voters in particular tended to go for those smaller parties I mentioned, the Greens and the Free Democrats. But another reason is that the conservatives, or the Christian Democrats, I should say, they lost their most popular figure, and that was Merkel herself. You know, Armin Laschet, he ran a pretty poor campaign. He had a bit of a scandal. He was seen laughing at a pretty somber event over the summer in the aftermath of Germany's deadly flooding, which you might remember. That really hurt him in the polls. And I think, frankly, people just didn't really see him as a successor to Merkel. And comparatively, I mean, with the Social Democrats, Olaf Scholz, who was kind of their pick for chancellor, you know, he was a trusted figure. He's someone that Germans know. He served as vice chancellor because it's worth remembering that the Social Democrats and Merkel's CDU, they've been governing together in coalition for the last 4 years and have done so previously. So Scholz is not, you know, a new figure. And he kind of, you know, I think made a really successful play at trying to portray himself to German voters as almost a Merkel continuation. I believe the way his campaign manager put it to me and a small group of journalists last week was that he's Merkel with a plan. So I think they really did try to play off her popularity and say, if you want someone who's close to Merkel, then you should vote for us.
We're talking about the recent elections in Germany with Yasmin Serhan, who's staff writer at The Atlantic.
So, you know, we have this sense that there was, you know, obviously it was the center party, center right and center left that had formed coalition before to actually create the government. If you move to the right on that spectrum and you come to the AfD, which you've mentioned to us, the far right party, the AfD actually retained a seat at the table. And ever since it sort of, you know, reemerged as a player here, there's been a fair bit of anxiety about what a rising far right in Germany might mean. How do you read what the AfD, sort of what its popularity is right now and what it means?
Those are all very good questions. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think particularly after 2017, when they first entered the Bundestag with their historic 12.6% showing, this is the first time that a far right party has entered the Bundestag. You know, there was this huge scare about, you know, what does this mean for Germany? Obviously, particularly given the sensitivities around their history, there was a lot of concerns that to have such a, you know, xenophobic and far right party in German politics would be quite dangerous. And you know, and it certainly has. We felt it over the last 4 years. And I asked a lot of people about this when I was in Germany, about the impact that they've had. I mean, even if they're relatively small compared to the other parties, I think their impact has really been demonstrable. I mean, they've really changed the tenor of German politics. And I think what's important to remember, particularly from an outsider's perspective, this is at least is what really struck me when I was there, is that German politics is rather consensual in nature. Like, it doesn't feel quite as tense or name-call-y in the sense that we might see here in Britain or indeed even in the United States. To just give you an example of that, when I was speaking to the Social Democrats campaign manager, he had noted that while he believed Olaf Scholz was the best candidate, he did say, you know, but the other candidates are also good people. And I feel like, just, you know, you wouldn't really expect to hear that in other countries' politics, perhaps even our own. And, you know, the AfD kind of parachuting into that environment, I think, really sort of shook the German political system in a pretty big way. You know, one of the first things they said when they entered the Bundestag was that they were going to hunt Merkel. I mean, this is really not the kind of language that you would be used to in Germany. And of course, you know, they sort of broached a lot of issues, immigration being their signature issue, really trying to politicize that 2015 decision to allow hundreds of thousands of immigrants to enter the country. So yeah, there was a big concern, I remember at the time, that, you know, what happens if the AFD gains more support and, you know, God forbid, is able to enter government or makes it so that, you know, they take up too much of the parliamentary real estate that the parties have to deal with them. Thankfully, 4 years on, that really hasn't come to pass. What we see in Germany today is that for all the uncertainty around the election results, you know, we're still waiting for the coalition negotiations to happen. We still don't quite know who the chancellor is going to be. What I think we could say definitively is that the AfD is going to play no role in the coalition negotiations determining what will be the next German government, because put simply, no other party wants to work with them. They've maintained a cordon sanitaire around that party because they're just seen to be too toxic. And indeed, you know, the party did lose some support, as I mentioned, relative to 2017. They're down to, I think, about 10% of the vote share. That doesn't mean that they've gone away. I mean, their stronghold in East Germany, they still have a very strong presence there. They're still going to have representation in the Bundestag. And it is also worth noting that now that they've re-entered the Bundestag for the second time, or now that they're about to, the party is going to have access to many of the benefits that the other parties already have, including federal campaign funding, as well as an affiliated organization or a foundation, which all the other parties have. So, you know, they are becoming a really established part of the German political system, but they remain as toxic as ever, I think.
Now, assuming that, so your point that we don't yet know who is going to be the chancellor, but assuming that Olaf Scholz becomes chancellor, is he just Merkel with a plan? Is there something that the globe should be expecting that would be quite different from his leadership relative to how, for example, the U.S. will be positioned with Germany?
No, it's a good question. And it's a question that I put to a lot of the Social Democrat leaders and campaign officials that I met. And, you know, I think what really struck me when I was in Germany, that in large part, all of the kind of main parties were really sort of singing to the same tune when it came to priorities. Climate change was a huge big ticket item in this election. It was something that came up virtually everywhere. And this included talking to other parties like the Free Democrats and the Christian Democrats as well. And of course, the pandemic. I mean, we can't forget the pandemic, that being the biggest issue of this year and likely kind of, you know, into the future. I think these are some of the priorities. Obviously, Europe and Germany's place in Europe, I think, is always going to be of the foremost importance. And just because it wasn't really mentioned in the election that much, in fact, it's worth noting here that foreign policy wasn't really an issue that came up a lot in this election. And I think that speaks to the fact that perhaps there are a lot of domestic issues that Germany was focused on. But, you know, when it comes to Europe, when it comes to the relationship with China, I was told by the Social Democrat officials that I spoke to that Germany is largely going to stay the course on those things. But I would expect that climate change is the huge issue that Germany will likely want to work with the United States and other allies on as well.
I'm just sort of can't really pick my jaw up off the ground to imagine that climate change would be driving national politics.
I mean, it was funny because it was joked that one person I spoke to told me jokingly that, you know, Germans talk about climate change like they alone can fix it, which, of course, is not really the case. But, you know, I think you have to remember that this summer, you know, we saw this all over the world. But I think Europe in particular, there were extreme heat waves. The flooding hit Germany really hard. And I really think that was an incredibly deadly flooding that the country experienced over the summer. I think that really pushed the issue to the top of the agenda. I too was kind of surprised, but it was also nice to see that, you know, this is obviously a pressing issue. We have the COP26 coming up in November here in the UK. So, you know, there's hopefully going to be a lot of focus on this. And Germany, I'm sure their voices will be quite loud as well.
Yasmin Serhan is staff writer at The Atlantic. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry.
Right now, out-of-control wildfires are raging across California. Firefighters desperate to contain the flame.
Wildfires devastating the West Coast and other parts of the country, from California to New Mexico and Alaska and Minnesota.
Hellish fires ravaging the Sequoia National Forest.
8 of the 10 largest fires in California's history have sparked since 2017. And 2020 was the most active wildfire season in those years, with more than 4 million acres of land burned. Wildfires are one of the greatest climate change challenges that we're facing right now, and they're not just a California problem. Smoke from these wildfires is reaching all corners of the U.S., causing hazy skies and poor air quality.
Well, if you looked outside, you noticed it was another hazy day in the tri-state because of the smoke from the West Coast wildfires. The air quality got pretty bad this morning. In fact, it was the worst it's been in two decades now.
Because of those fires, Colorado's air quality is as bad as it's been in years.
California is especially impacted.
Across the Bay Area, air quality is a major concern today. Even if you can't smell the smoke, you can see it.
I can tell you that smoke from the Northern California brush fires has made its way into the LA basin, blanketing it.
A recent analysis of federal satellite imagery by NPR's California Newsroom and Stanford University's Environmental Change and Human Outcomes Lab found that dangerous smoke from West Coast wildfires is being carried thousands of miles across the country. And the number of days that some communities are exposed to this toxic smoke is increasing. That's a reality that could impact the health of all of us. The investigation also found that decades of poor forest management from both California state officials and the federal government, along with a lack of prescribed burns, has left California's forests overgrown with brush and small trees and ripe for sparked fire. We spoke with Allison Saldana, investigative data reporter for NPR's California Newsroom.
We started out with this idea that we wanted to understand how residents across the U.S. are affected by the smoke from wildfires that are burning in the West. So to do that, we partnered with Stanford University's Environmental Change and Human Outcomes Lab. And using data from NOAA, which is federal satellite imagery, we mapped what the images show of smoke across the U.S. onto zip codes, and then use that to analyze how things have gotten worse over the decade. So that data is available for over 10 years now. So we decided to bunch the years into a before times when wildfires were less destructive. So that's probably around from 2009 to 2013. And that was our before times. And then we looked at the current period when we can see that extreme wildfire events are repeated and more destructive. And so that's how we compared how every zip code across America is now breathing in smoke compared to a few years ago.
And how far is the smoke reaching?
This data shows that smoke exposure is not something that's just limited to Northern California or the Central Valley. It's actually spread across the U.S. and clear across the country. In Boston, we can see a 50% rise in smoke exposure. Residents here are now breathing in close to a month of smoke compared to before.
Okay. So people in Boston are now breathing in more smoke because of wildfires in California?
Yep, that's what the research is starting to show. It's not just California's wildfires, it's even Oregon, and definitely there's some impact from Canada. But we can see that as the wildfires particularly get stronger and wilder in California, it's impacting the whole country.
Now, what are the health risks associated with the smoke? Is it just an annoyance?
No, it's actually pretty disturbing. Scientists and researchers in general are still catching up because this is a fairly new phenomenon. So there's not something we can definitively say that exposure to wildfire smoke is definitely causing this, that, and whatever else. But we do know that the smoke is impacting your lungs. It's impacting your heart. It causes cognitive declines. There are studies that show that it could be linked to Alzheimer's. The new research seems to show that there are preterm births that are linked to exposure to wildfire smoke. We decided to dive further into the hospitalizations in California because this is the state that's sort of driving the change in exposure to smoke. And we analyzed how hospitalizations for heart and lung diseases have grown over the years. And what we found from the publicly available data sets is that in 2018, there were 30,000 more hospitalizations for heart and lung diseases compared to 2016, which was a less destructive fire year.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about PM2.5? What is it?
So PM2.5 is the fine particulate matter. It's a really dangerous pollutant that moves through the air. It's so tiny, it's 10 times smaller than a strand of human hair. And once it's ingested, because it's so tiny, it can go deep into your lungs. If you're pregnant, it could affect your fetus. It could affect your brain. It definitely is known to affect your heart and lungs. And there's still so much research to be done on how these really tiny particles can ruin quality of life and even cause premature death.
So as I'm listening to you, I'm reflecting on all of the misinformation there is circulating around the COVID-19 vaccines and the real fear so many people fear about taking those vaccines because they're worried about things like effect on a pregnancy or effect on your lungs or any of these things. And yet there's very little, I mean, actually there's no scientific evidence to suggest that those things are real. But you're telling me that you've got a decade of data showing that these wildfires are having a real effect across the country. Why isn't this the front page news kind of everywhere?
I guess it's because of the fact that you can't see it. And it's a more insidious sort of problem. You cannot see the smoke in the air, especially in the East. And in the Midwest, as the smoke from the wildfires travel greater distances, they move higher in the sky. That doesn't mean that it's not present in the air. It just means that you can't see it. And so when it affects you, you're not quite sure what is affecting it. And I guess it's more palpable in the West. But as people sort of move around, and especially as it starts to get further into the air, and we're looking at five-year averages, that is what our data has been looking at. So everything I've been saying right now, it's like residents in LA are exposed to a month on average of wildfire smoke. You don't realize that you're breathing in this because it's invisible.
So obviously this is a challenging problem to address. It crosses multiple states. You're talking about things again around, you know, 5-year averages, and most people get elected for 2 to 4 years. So, so it makes it really tough to think about how to engage public policy to address this. But what are some of the legislative or public policy ways that we can think about impacting this issue?
Well, one of the main things that we found from this investigation is that forest management needs to become front and center. There needs to be more investment to ensure that there are prescribed burns that take place regularly that sort of help to control these wildfires. It involves exposing people to a little bit of smoke from the controlled burns, but as the experts we spoke to said, it's better to have a little bit of smoke exposure in a controlled setting than to let these wildfire blazes just sort of run through the West and then impact the entire country. And one of the main takeaways has been that in Florida, which has seen, compared to the rest of the US, Florida is witnessing a decline in its smoke exposure. For areas that were typically, you know, recording high smoke exposure from wildfires. And that's because they've been doing prescribed burns pretty diligently. The only parts of Florida that had actually sort of seen a rise in smoke exposure were counties that are recording burning of sugar crops before the harvest.
I'm remembering as you're talking about burning the sugar crops, we did a conversation about that, which was something that I hadn't known about until we did it. And so like immediately in my mind, I'm sorry, I was thinking about the conversation that we'd had about burning the sugar cane.
Yeah, no, it was quite surprising because initially we were like, why is Florida showing these great declines in this data set? Everywhere else, it's like increasing, and we can see that the air is getting worse and Florida is getting better. It's not that Florida is much better. It's still exposed to quite a few days of smoke, but it's definitely a decline from less than a decade ago. And when we narrowed it down and looked at the places that are still recording an increase in the state, you can see that those are the ones where there are a lot of sugar crops, and those are also the places that are recording sugar crop burning. So, yeah.
So, of course, you saying that then also makes me want to ask, because with the burning of the sugarcane crop, one of the critical issues is that it has a disparate effect on racial communities and communities with fewer economic means. Is that similar here, given sort of how wide this problem is? Does it still have a disparate effect on more vulnerable communities?
I definitely think so, because the wildfire smoke is affecting everybody. So there's no real escaping this situation. Everybody is exposed to the wildfire smoke. But the people who are more likely to bear the costs of that exposure are people from vulnerable communities, people from poorer communities who incidentally happen to be Black, Brown, or Indigenous, because they're the ones who are already possibly exposed to other pollutants, and therefore that impairs their bodies and their ability to sort of fight the exposure from wildfire smoke. And as this sort of gets worse, it's going to impair their immunity. And we already have research that shows that in California and a few other parts of the West, there was this Harvard study that recently came out that said that it actually caused more cases of COVID-19 than before because people were exposed to wildfire smoke.
Allison Saldana is an investigative data reporter for NPR's California Newsroom. Allison, thank you for joining us, and thank you for this data and research.
Thank you, Melissa. It was great to be here.
That's all the politics we have for you today. Now it's time for some team shoutouts. Shanta Covington debuted at line producer this week, along with our regular captain, Jackie Martin, at the helm. Vince Fairchild and Jay Cowett are our control team and sound designers, and they're actually in the studio in New York City. Ethan Opperman is our acting senior producer, and his crew is Meg Dalton, Katarina Barton, and Deborah Goldstein. Zach Bynum is our digital editor, David Gable is our executive assistant, and Lee Hill is our executive producer. We love you spending some of your day with us, and we always want to hear from you. So call us at 877-869-8253 about anything. We always want to hear from you. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway.